This podcast was recorded at the 2016 Jad Pro Live at AppShow Conference in Washington, D.C. The title of this session is Management of Patients with Chemotherapy-Induced Nausea and Vomiting, and it is presented by Sally Yowell Barbour, Duke University Hospital. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions. And now, we're delighted to bring you this podcast from Jad Pro Live.
We're delighted to have our next speaker join us. Please welcome Dr. Sally Barbour of the Duke University Hospital as she discusses management of patients with chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting.
So today we're going to be talking about some of the recent advancements in the management of patients with chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting. The learning objectives are here, but basically just talk about the different agents that are available, talk about some of the risk factors and how looking at the immunogenicity of our chemotherapy agents, as some of those have been somewhat reclassified, and then really talk about how we as advanced practitioners can play a role in anticipating and preventing nausea and vomiting in our cancer patients. So I have nothing to disclose. So I always like to start out with just a little bit of background, which I know we all are well aware that nausea and vomiting is one of the side effects that patients really fear the most, and they talk to their friends and they know that they're going to throw up, and they come and they talk to you, and it's really one of the things they're most concerned about. And so this is really just a good, I think, table to show sort of where we've come from and really to reiterate that we still have some work to do. So back in the 80s, nausea and vomiting, and specifically vomiting, was really one of the things that patients feared the most. As we've had advancements in our pharmacologic management of this side effect with the introduction of the serotonin receptor antagonist, you can see that vomiting really sort of fell, well, not off, it really fell down in the rankings, and nausea was still an issue. And as we've introduced newer agents such as the NK1 antagonist and really learned better how to categorize the risk factors, we see vomiting again has continued to stay, while in the top five, sort of down towards the bottom. But you can see that nausea continues to be a problem, and that continues to be one of the main problems that we face today in management of these patients. So we know that it remains a challenge. There are numerous international and national guidelines that are available that I'm sure you're all well familiar with. They're all updated on a regular basis. MASC was recently updated this year. NCCN and ASCO, of which I'm lucky enough to be on those guidelines, are in the process of updating their guidelines. Those guidelines are great, and they're accessible to everyone, and they offer a really great framework to make sure that patients and practitioners use the most appropriate antiemetics for their patients. A lot of practices, whether you like it or not, have electronic medical records, and one of the benefits of these is that we can pre-build templates, and we can build these templates with appropriate antiemetics so that patients are getting appropriate prophylactic regimens. As I mentioned, we've introduced a lot of new drugs over the past 30 years, and those have really made some advancements in how we've been able to manage this problem. But despite all of this, as I alluded to, we still have a lot of patients that are fearful, a lot of patients that have problems with nausea and vomiting, and really more in the delayed setting, and really, at least in my practice and at least what the literature shows, it's really nausea that continues to be a significant problem. So why does it remain a problem if we have all these great guidelines and we have all these great drugs? Well, one is that they don't get prescribed appropriately. There's a lot of data out there that shows that people meaning us, providers underestimate how well or not well patients are doing. We don't necessarily follow the appropriate guidelines. Either it's because of lack of awareness, or people don't think that this patient really needs that, or whatever. The guidelines, and there's data out there that shows that they're not necessarily followed. We have patients that can't afford their antiemetics, so there's issues with not adherence. The guidelines don't address all scenarios. So we obviously, there are a lot of regimens that are multi-day. We have patients stem cell transplant, and those aren't addressed really in the guidelines. They really are focused on more single-day chemotherapy. So we're not doing patient case, but I just sort of am introducing one that'll sort of guide the discussion as we go through. So this is probably someone who's familiar to a lot of folks in this room. A.H., she's a 44-year-old female. She really has no significant past medical history. She presents with a four-month history of weakness and fatigue. She has never smoked. She doesn't drink. She's got three young children. She's busy. She had morning sickness with all of her pregnancies, and she ends up being diagnosed with a 10-centimeter cecal mass and liver lesion. So she is going to be starting FOLFOX chemotherapy. So what is her risk factor for nausea and vomiting? So again, you all know FOLFOX, it's leucovorin, 5-FU, and oxaliplatin. So when we are working with patients, the first thing to look at is what are their risk factors. So obviously the first is to look at what chemotherapy getting and how likely is that chemotherapy or that combination of chemotherapy agents, what is the immunogenicity of that regimen? And we'll talk a little bit more about that in the next couple of slides. Other risk factors that we know contribute to risk, although we don't necessarily know the best way to incorporate all of them, are things such as younger age. So we know that the younger patients are, it's harder. They're more at risk for having issues with nausea and vomiting. Females are more at risk. Patients that don't have a significant alcohol intake history, patients that do have history of nausea with motion sickness or with pregnancy. So when we look at this patient, she pretty much has all sorts of risk factors that are going to contribute and increase her risk of having nausea and vomiting. So looking more specifically at the regimens themselves, so all of the guidelines categorize the agents into one of four different risk factors. So our high risk factor drugs are drugs that in greater than 90% of patients, we know that if we did nothing, are going to cause patients to have nausea and vomiting. The moderate risk category, which is arguably very wide ranging, and so this is where sometimes we run into issues, is our regimens are drugs that cause immunogenicity in 30 to 90% of patients. So again, you know, there's a significant difference between, you know, if you're in the 85% versus, you know, 35%. And then we have our low and minimal, which really for the most part don't require a whole lot of antiemetic prophylaxis. So looking more specifically, and these are based on the NCCN, the current version of the NCCN guidelines. So what are the regimens or the drugs that are considered high risk? I would say that the two that stand out the most and that are probably the most widely used are cisplatin. And really any dose of cisplatin is classified as highly immunogenic. And then the AC combination, which used to be moderately immunogenic, and that is one of the things that when we look at some of the studies that are in moderately immunogenic chemotherapy, a significant amount of those patients were receiving AC, which now all the guidelines, whether they have reclassified them as high or put them in their own separate class but treat them as high, for the purpose of this, they're all high. So all those patients should be receiving really all our recommendations for highly immunogenic chemotherapy. Some of our more common drugs in the moderate setting or moderate category are drugs like carboplatin, which again is one of the drugs that's been discussed a lot in the guidelines for this year. Lower doses of some of our anthracyclines, irinotecan, and oxaliplatin. So when we look at our patient, she's getting oxaliplatin, which is moderate, and her other chemotherapy drug is low. So she's getting a moderately immunogenic chemotherapy regimen, but again, she pretty much has all of those risk factors. She's young, she's a female, she didn't drink, she didn't smoke, and she had nausea and vomiting when she was pregnant. So while she's moderate in terms of her chemotherapy, one could argue that you would treat her as a high-risk patient based on all of her other risk factors. Again, the low emetogenic regimens are regimens like docetaxel, paclitaxel, pemetrexed. These are regimens that really only cause nausea in about 10 to 30%, or vomiting in about 10 to 30% of patients. And then the minimal agents are there. One of the challenges that the guidelines historically have not addressed, but at least the NCCN guidelines have attempted in the past several years, is to really incorporate the oral chemotherapy agents. It's obviously, as we all know, there's a ton of them out there, and really trying to add them to the guidelines to provide some guidance with how to best manage these. And for the most part, these drugs have fallen into a minimal to low category, but there are a few, such as oral cyclophosphamide, procarbazine, that really have the potential to cause nausea and vomiting. So NCCN has attempted to provide some guidance, and really in those in patients receiving those drugs, they do recommend giving scheduled antiemetics, at least for some part of the treatment. So again, AH, she's receiving moderate to high, a moderate emetogenic regimen. Potentially, you could increase her to a high risk. What is the best thing to give her, and what other guidelines actually recommend? So as I mentioned, there are really three large groups out there that have put out guidelines. MASC updated theirs in the spring. NCCN and ASCO are in the midst of updating theirs. I don't know when they'll be out, but they are in the works. But for the most part, the guidelines are pretty much in agreement with how they recommend patients be treated. So for patients receiving highly emetogenic chemotherapy regimens, really, all of these patients should be receiving a three-drug regimen consisting of a serotonin antagonist, NK1 antagonist, and dexamethasone. As I mentioned, AC is, whether it's recategorized as high or has been given its own separate category, is also recommended to be treated with a three-drug regimen. And new to the MASC guidelines is carboplatin. So carboplatin has been pulled out of the moderate set, a moderate category, and has been recommended to be treated with a three-drug regimen similar to the high-risk drugs. The NCCN guidelines have always listed carboplatin as one of those drugs that you could consider using an NK1 antagonist and adding it to the two-drug regimen if your patient was at higher risk. But at least to date, ASCO and NCCN have left carboplatin in the moderate category. So for those drugs that are in the moderate category, again, the recommendation is a serotonin antagonist plus dexamethasone. And then for low, really any one of either just dexamethasone, a dopamine antagonist, or a serotonin antagonist are recommended. And then, again, for minimal emetogenic drugs, no prophylaxis is recommended. So olanzapine you see listed there. So olanzapine is another drug that we'll talk a little bit about more later, which has been listed in the NCCN guidelines as an option. And the regimen listed in the NCCN guideline actually substitutes olanzapine for an NK1 antagonist. So there's a lot of data out there with olanzapine, and we'll get to a little bit more about that later. For the delayed setting, again, the guidelines, it really depends on what you've given in the acute setting. So for highly emetogenic regimens, patients should be receiving scheduled antiemetics in the delayed setting. One thing you will notice is that there is no serotonin antagonist recommended to be scheduled. It is a knee-jerk reaction. I find that everybody prescribes everybody serotonin antagonist, but in the highly emetogenic setting, it is not recommended in the delayed setting. Depending on what NK1 antagonist is given, it will or won't be continued in the delayed setting. You know, so if you're using fosaprepitant, obviously it's just a one-time dose, but if you're using a prepitant, it's 3 days. If you're using one of the newer agents, it's also just 1 day. So that really depends. And then in the moderate setting, it's also recommended that patients should be receiving some scheduled antiemetic. And here, the guidelines are pretty consistent in recommending either a corticosteroid such as dexamethasone or a serotonin antagonist. And then for patients receiving low or minimal emetogenic regimens, no routine prophylaxis is recommended. Although, obviously, we all know it, but it's always good to remind folks that everybody should go home with something to have available as needed. So a little bit, I'll just shift into some of the newer agents that are available. So there are two new NK1 antagonists that have become available in the last year or so. The first is natupotent, which is a fixed-dose combination of natupotent plus palonosetron. It's often referred to as NEPA, I refer to it as natupotent. So it's FDA-approved for the prevention of acute and delayed nausea and vomiting in patients receiving either initial or repeat courses of chemotherapy. So this is a selective NK1 receptor antagonist. In terms of some of the potentials for drug interactions, it is metabolized by 3A4, and it is an inhibitor of 3A4. So similar to aprepitant and fosaprepitant, there is the potential for drug interactions with this with this NK1 antagonist. As I mentioned, it's given as a single dose, again, there is the potential for the drug interaction. So you'll see that similar to when you're using a aprepitant or fosaprepitant, the dexamethasone dose is adjusted. So there are a lot of studies out there. For the sake of time, I'm just going to share one with you. So this is a phase three study looking at the natupotent palonostron combination in patients receiving moderately emetogenic chemotherapy. So again, as I alluded to at the beginning, these patients are receiving AC-based chemotherapy, which at the time of the study was moderately emetogenic, but as we know now is really highly emetogenic. So it's just important to keep those things in mind when you're evaluating these studies. So they looked at about 1,400 patients. They were randomized to receive the NK1 serotonin antagonist combination with Dex or just Palo and Dex, both given orally and both just given on the day of chemotherapy. No patients received any scheduled antiemetics, so they just got their antiemetics on day one and then had PRN metoclopramide given to them. The primary endpoint was complete response, so no emesis and no use of rescue, and it was during the delayed phase. So they're looking at the efficacy in that roughly 25 to 120-hour period following cycle one. Their secondary endpoints were similar CR, but in the acute and in the overall phase. So if you look here at their primary endpoint, again, which was efficacy in the delayed phase, they met their endpoint, no surprise. So it was statistically significant difference in the patients that received the combination that included the NK1 antagonist. And then looking at their secondary endpoints, you can see that, again, in the acute as well as the overall phase, they also showed a statistically significant improvement in the patients that received the NK1 antagonist compared to those who did not. So their conclusions were obviously that this was an effective combination. It offered the potential for a convenient single-day prophylactic CINV regimen, again, because these patients didn't receive any scheduled antiemetics in the delayed setting. As we would expect, the most common side effects were headache and constipation. And they didn't see a whole lot of other side effects that you would expect. So the other agent that's become recently available is relopatant. So this is also an oral agent. An IV agent is coming soon. But currently all that's available on the market is the oral agent, which is, again, an NK1 selective receptor antagonist. It's FDA approved to be used with other agents in the prevention of delayed nausea and vomiting. And one of the differences with this drug with some of the other NK1 antagonists is the potential lack of drug interactions. So this does not inhibit 3A4. And while that's, we always talk about 3A4, and yes, there are a lot of other enzymes, but 3A4 is the big one. And so it doesn't inhibit that. So there is not the potential or the similar risk of potential with other, as you see with other NK1 antagonists. So important to remind folks is that if they're using this, you don't have to adjust the dexamethasone dose. And I think there are some people that are young enough in their practice that the only thing they know is the 12 milligram dexamethasone dose. So if you're using this, I think it's important to remind folks that they do need to increase that dexamethasone dose back up to 20 milligrams. So it is available, as I mentioned, as oral tablets only, but again, an IV formulation is in the works. So again, numerous studies, but I'm just sharing one in the moderately emetogenic setting. So this was a phase three study by Lee Schwartzberg and colleagues looking again at, in a phase three study, looking at patients receiving moderately emetogenic chemotherapy. And again, I don't know how well you can read it pretty well at the bottom, but again, these are patients getting cyclophosphamide and doxorubicin. So again, it's moderately emetogenic, but in reality, some of the regimens are actually more highly emetogenic. So these patients received an all-oral regimen. They received relopatant, granisetron, and dexamethasone, or placebo with dexamethasone and granisetron. A little bit different than the previous study is that these patients did receive scheduled antiemetics in the delayed setting. So for 2 days, they received scheduled granisetron. The endpoints are similar, with the primary endpoint being complete response in the delayed phase and secondary endpoints There were numerous ones, but in terms of efficacy, again, looking at the efficacy in the acute and then the overall phase. So again, in terms of their primary endpoint of complete response in the delayed phase, they found a significant difference in the patients that received the reloptant as opposed to patients who did not receive an NK1 antagonist. In looking at their secondary endpoints, the middle section there is efficacy in the acute phase, and they actually didn't see a significant difference, but they did see a significant difference in the overall phase. Hence, their approval is in the delayed setting. So again, the conclusion, similar to the previous study, the NK1 antagonist reloptant was well tolerated. It offered benefit, and again, you know, we see our most common side effects as headache, constipation, which are typically associated with our serotonin antagonist that they're all getting. So what are some of the potential advantages with these oral NK1 antagonists, and what are some of the potential disadvantages? I'm just curious. I know there's no audience response, but how many of you are using these newer oral NK1 antagonists in your practice? Okay, I see a few hands up. So they do offer some advantages. They are all oral combination. Offer you the potential to use an all-oral combination if you're using oral dex and oral serotonin antagonists. I think any of us that have used fosaprepitant are aware that there's potential injection site reactions. People react sometimes to the fosaprepitant, so it does offer an alternative there. Again, the convenience of that single one-day regimen, and at least in the APRO study, they didn't receive anything in the delayed setting, it offers that option. So if you have patients where you are concerned with adherence or adherence, you know, that offers a benefit. And then while we're not going to really go into a lot of detail, a lot of folks continue to have concerns about dexamethasone and the use of dexamethasone. And so we use dexamethasone in our patients. But if you have concerns, just the fact that they're not giving steroids in the delayed setting, and again, going back to that, everything being given on day one, so it does offer that opportunity. With everything, there's advantages and challenges or disadvantages. So at least some of the challenges that in talking to folks around the country and at least at our own institution we've run into is, you know, okay, so not everybody can take something oral, so there's that option. And really, it's really come down to cost and the ability to obtain the drugs and get them on formulary and all that. So I think that's really been more of our challenge. And then at least at our institution, and I don't know, you know, how others are, patients aren't allowed to get drugs and then bring them to the treatment room, so that offers challenges as well. But the drugs themselves work and are very effective. So just the last new drug, which I'll use quotations for, is olanzapine. So olanzapine, as we all know, has been around for a really, really long time, so it's not new at all. It's an antipsychotic, which is something that when we use it in patients, I always have to make sure that I tell them, so when they go to the pharmacy, they're not shocked. So there have been a lot of studies with olanzapine, phase 2 studies, small studies. Rudy Navari is really the champion of this drug in using it in the CINV setting. What is its role? So there have been studies looking at it as I mentioned, as part of a 3-drug combination taking the place of the NK1 receptor antagonist. It's been, there's studies, and we'll look at one of them where it's been used in combination, so as a 4th drug, and then in the breakthrough setting. The most common side effect is sedation, which is not minimal. So again, the one study that I'm just going to share with you is a phase 3 study that was recently published this July, I think. It's a phase 3 study looking at olanzapine combined with an NK1, a serotonin antagonist, and dexamethasone. So this was a phase 3 trial in highly metagenic chemotherapy patients. They were receiving either cisplatin or an AC-based chemotherapy regimen. So again, they received the drugs I mentioned. They could receive either oral aprepitant or they could receive IV fosaprepitant. So it was up to the investigator to choose. So they either got olanzapine plus the 3 drugs or they got placebo plus the current recommended 3-drug regimen. The primary endpoint, which is different from all the studies that we've talked about, was nausea. So again, nausea continues to be the main problem or one of the most significant problems, and that was the primary endpoint in this study. The secondary endpoint was our complete response of no emesis and no use of rescue. So if they got aprepitant, they got the whole 3-day regimen. These patients did receive dexamethasone and olanzapine or placebo for 3 days, as is currently recommended in the guidelines to receive scheduled antiemetics after highly immunogenic chemotherapy. In terms of efficacy, again, primary endpoint was nausea. It was statistically significant, pretty significantly, so in terms of meeting its primary endpoint of no nausea. So in the acute phase, you can see there was a difference of almost 30%. In the delayed and overall phase, it was also statistically significantly better. Their secondary endpoint of complete response was also, they also achieved that in the acute and overall setting. As I mentioned, sedation has been the big side effect, and they really find that to be significant on day two, and then it tends to fall back to sort of more normal on days three and four. So in summary, olanzapine has been shown to be effective in a four-drug option, as evidenced by that study. It is an option to use if patients, for whatever reasons, can't tolerate an NK1 antagonist. It has been shown to offer significant improvement in nausea, which has really been the bane of our existence for a long time. But you have to recognize that it does have this side effect of sedation, and the current dose that is used in these studies is 10 milligrams. And I know that there's a lot of people that when they do use it, don't even think about starting at 10 milligrams. They use 5. I've heard people use 2.5. It's hard to know. The data is with 10 milligrams, but this is where you have to, you know, you look at the guidelines and you look at your patient and try to make the best decision. So just briefly, our patient AH, so she received, we decided she was highly immunogenic, at high risk, so she received a highly immunogenic-based regimen, but she had breakthrough nausea. So I just wanted to point out, sort of on the tail of olanzapine, just to remind folks about breakthrough nausea and vomiting. Obviously, when folks are having this, you just really need to use a different agent from a different class. I can't tell you how many times I see people just give more Zofran when people are already on scheduled Zofran, or they've gotten Palo and they give them more Zofran, or they're on a patch and they give them more Zofran. You've got to use something from a different class, whatever it is. Obviously, if they're vomiting, you need to bring them in for something IV. And then the other thing is obviously just to make sure that you're constantly reassessing and make changes. If you used a 3-drug regimen and they did terrible, I don't know, add olanzapine. You know, try something different, try something from a different class. And I will say, although I didn't include it here just because I didn't think we'd have time, you know, there is, but I do have the reference there. Olanzapine has been compared to metoclopramide in the breakthrough setting and is superior to metoclopramide. So olanzapine has been shown to be an effective agent to use in the breakthrough setting as well. So just to shift gears a little bit, and again, this is kind of like preaching to the choir, but we all know that nausea and vomiting negatively impacts patients' quality of life. So I'm obviously a pharmacist, so I'm using a survey that our Hem-Onc Pharmacy Association did just to, support my point. So they did a survey of 400 patients receiving chemotherapy, and as you would expect, 3 of the 4 patients who had nausea and vomiting said it negatively impacted their existence. It made them not want to take any more chemo. It had messed with their personal plans. It had caused them to change how they eat. They've had to call in sick for work. I think we can't underestimate that this, even though we think we're doing a really good job, continues to happen, and that it does have a negative impact on their quality of life. Another study that really just sort of reinforces this, and you can, if you just look at the top 3 bars there, those are all nausea. So really what this showed is that while we know globally that nausea and vomiting negatively impacts a patient quality of life, it is really more nausea. So speaking from my own experience, I would rather just throw up and have it be over with. But being continuously nauseous is just miserable. So really that's what this showed, that the nausea has a greater impact, a negative impact on patients' quality of life, and that it's more likely associated with highly immunogenic chemotherapy regimens. So what is our role as advanced practice providers? I think we probably know what it is, and there's a lot of potential opportunities for us. So opportunities in obviously direct patient care, but also in making sure that people are in your institution or your practice are following the guidelines. So whether it be participating in the development of these guidelines, being that champion, I think it's important to have someone at your institution. And the reality is this typically not going to be a physician. Really take this up as a cause and making sure that there are guidelines available for people to follow. If you have an EMR, making sure that those are incorporated into your order sets or somehow a part of, you know, as pharmacists, we make sure that it's part of their verification process, that when they're looking at those orders and they see that they're getting whatever chemotherapy, that it's part of that to make sure that if they're getting cisplatin, that there's also orders for all the appropriate supportive care, including nausea and vomiting. We're all involved in taking care of patients and making sure the planning of their therapy, but making sure that patients are appropriately assessed. You know, it's one thing to have it all built in the guideline, but, you know, FOLFOX is built as moderate. But if you have our patient here who's got five other risk factors, it's important to make sure that you're amending those and remembering that guidelines are just guidelines, and it's important that we're all taking part in assessing the patient and at making changes if we need to. One of the biggest things that we all can do is educating our coworkers. It's amazing. There's a lot of folks out there that have no idea really what the guidelines. They haven't looked at them in so long. They still remember the guidelines from 10 years ago or whatever. So every opportunity you have, whether it be with students, with other physicians, with fellows, with coworkers, with new NPs or new PAs that are coming along, making sure to help educate them on how to best manage these patients is extremely important. And then one of the other things is patient education. I think patients can't hear it enough, so whether they're hearing it from somebody in clinic and then they're hearing it from somebody in the treatment room, making sure that, A, that they're aware of what the risks are, but making sure they also are very clear in how to take their antiemetic medications if they do have medicines to take in the delayed setting, making sure that we always try to do it in advance so that if there are obstacles with them obtaining these medications because they're expensive or because they don't have insurance. I mean, I always think, well, gee, Compazine's cheap, but there are patients that even Compazine at $20, they can't swing. So making sure, and olanzapine, that's cheap, but it's still not totally cheap. I think I just called the pharmacy the other day and it was like $250 for, you know, a month. So it's inexpensive, but it's not as inexpensive as, you know, dexamethasone or something. So, but talking to patients and making sure they're educated and making sure that, again, maybe it's not you that are going over dealing with those insurance obstacles, but making sure that you're aware of them so that they can be referred to the appropriate folks. And then constantly, you know, an initial and ongoing risk assessment, but also to see how they're doing. MASC has a tool. We call back our patients that are at high risk the day or two after chemotherapy to see how they're doing, so that we can make changes if we need to, whether it's a nurse from your treatment area, whether it's you, whether it's somebody. Those types of things are very helpful in continually reassessing to see how patients are doing. Again, just in terms of the guidelines, we've based ours off of NCCN. Again, they're also very similar. Any of them are great. They offer a great framework to start from, and then really working with the pharmacist or whoever's at your institution to help make sure that you work with your formulary or whatever to make sure that they're making those choices. They have been shown to improve care. They optimize the ordering, and how patients, how well they do. They're good educational tools, so we use them with our students. We give them to all the fellows. We have pocket cards, and they help contain, you know, the cost of medications as well, which is always important to the pharmacy and those folks. So this is just an example, and again, it's an example that I have from the pharmacy literature, but I'm well aware that there's, you know, lots of data like this out there. But this really, and it's a small study, it was only looking at 106 patients, but it really sort of drives home the point of how we as more advanced practice providers compared to physicians have a different sort of viewpoint in management. So these 106 patients, roughly half of them were managed according to, in this case, a pharmacist protocol, and half of them were managed by the physicians. The physicians, 20% of those patients received excessive antiemetic prophylaxis, but they really didn't seem to do any different. And you can see in the bottom that the majority of the patients in the pharmacy group, you know, followed national guidelines compared to the physician. So you could substitute pharmacist to NP. And when I say pharmacist, like I work in the clinic, I was telling somebody I haven't mixed a chemotherapy drug in 18 years. So in North Carolina, we're licensed by the Board of Medicine as well, sort of similar to a, so there's a lot of pharmacists that are working in clinics. So I say, when I say pharmacist, that's kind of, you know, pharmacist, a PA, and I would say if you substituted that out, it would be the same. We probably do a better job following some of these things than our physician colleagues do. And what are the consequences of this overtreatment or undertreatment? You know, again, what are the consequences of not following these guidelines? Well, they're kind of obvious, but there's financial costs. Again, as I go back to my everybody giving everybody so much Zofran, it's generic, but it's still not cheap. Let me just tell you, it's still not cheap. So we still have, our nurses seem to spend so much time doing prior authorizations and overrides and whatever. So there's just time constraints, there's financial costs, there's side effects. You know, the 5-HT3 antagonists do cause constipation, headaches, you know, increases in your blood sugars with dexamethasone, excess pill burden. So that's where that one-day regimen, you know, can come in handy. We have patients get completely just confused, especially with the dex. You take it once on, then you take it twice a day. And then, you know, it can get very confusing, especially when you've got patients that might have brain mets or other things going on, or they are like somebody I saw in clinic recently who had never had to take a medicine in his life, and now all of a sudden he had all these medicines, and it's just overwhelming. And then there's the obvious downside of you know, uncontrolled nausea and vomiting. You know, if you undertreat patients and they have issues, then you introduce the potential for anticipatory nausea and vomiting. And then as that survey showed, you have patients that are like, I'm done, I'm not going to do this anymore. So there's always that risk of patients no longer wanting to continue with their care, have needing to come to the hospital, and increase of healthcare resources for fluids, you know, getting admitted to the hospital or whatever. So just in conclusion, chemotherapy-induced nausea and vomiting, despite all the advances that have been made, and we have made some significant advances over the years, continues to be a problem, especially in the delayed setting, and really especially nausea. So the new agents that have, the new and the not so new, but finding new use, NK1 receptor antagonists and olanzapine, they have been shown to be effective, and in the case of olanzapine, maybe offer better efficacy with nausea. So they've all been incorporated in some way into the guidelines. It'll be interesting to see when the other two new sets of guidelines come out, which I don't honestly know when that's going to be. See how sort of things change, like, you know, are they going to follow mask and increase carbo to a high? Are they going to incorporate olanzapine in there in a different way? It'll be interesting to sort of see. But again, just to remind everyone follow the guidelines, to use agents that have different mechanism of action, to constantly reassess your patients, and to really, again, say what we already know, that as advanced practice providers, nurses, and pharmacists, we all play a huge role in managing these patients and continually assessing them. And with that, I think I have 2 minutes to take questions. But if not, I'll... Anybody have any questions?
The 5-HT3 is not being indicated in delayed nausea for highly emetic. But in line 3, they are indicated in moderately. Am I reading that slide incorrectly?
No. So the question was, I made a comment about the serotonin antagonist in the delayed setting for highly emetogenic chemotherapy. So none of the guidelines recommend scheduled 5-HT3 antagonists beyond day one in highly emetogenic regimens. None of them. They do offer it. It is listed as an option in the moderate emetogenic regimens in the delayed setting, but it's not in the highly emetogenic setting.
Does that make sense?
So the data doesn't support that they really offer a whole lot of benefit in the highly emetogenic setting. There was a meta-analysis, I can't remember how many years ago, but it's been several years that the serotonin antagonists have not been listed in the guidelines for scheduled use after highly emetogenic chemotherapy. That doesn't mean people don't do it all the time,
no,
but it's not recommended by the guidelines.
And you didn't mention anything about benzodiazepine use.
So the question was about benzodiazepines. So benzodiazepines are really, They don't have a whole lot of benefit in terms of prophylaxis in CINV. Their big role is in anticipatory nausea and vomiting, so they do have a role in the anticipatory setting, but they're not, so they're, you know, so they can be used as needed, or they can be used in patients who do have a significant anticipatory component, but they're not part of the, you know, standard prophylactic regimens for all those levels of chemotherapy.
And then just one more question.
Mm-hmm.
Taxotere.
Yes.
I'm surprised to see that. I'm always surprised to see that as a low emetogenic potential. And I just wonder if that's your experience as well.
So the question was, she's surprised that docetaxel is listed as a low. Is that my experience? So we have not had patients have a lot of issues with docetaxel. Our patients all receive, at our institution, our regimen, our prophylactic recommendation for our low emetogenic chemotherapies, they get a steroid. So that's what our patients get. But again, if you have a patient who they're getting docetaxel, but they're 35, they're a female, you know, maybe they need to get bumped up. So that's just looking at the drug. That's not taking into anything else into consideration. So any other?
With these new agents that you mentioned today, are there advantages to these new NK1s over previous ones? Because obviously they're going to be more expensive.
Right. So the question was, is there any advantage to the newer NK1 antagonists over what's currently available? So they haven't been compared to one another. So you know, you can't say that efficacy-wise one is better than the other. They're all, because, you know, they've all been compared to a 5-HT3 plus Dex. So they've all been shown to be efficacious. So at least in my opinion, clinically, based on the data that we have, because we've reviewed all of these, our resident actually did it last year as her as a class review. So clinically, they're all equally effective. You can at least say that. There's no data that shows that one is better than the other. But then, you look at, or are there other things that might make you choose one more than the other? The rilopitant has the potential for less drug interactions, depending on your patient and depending maybe on what other medications they're on or whatever. That's an advantage that makes you want to use that over another one. The oral ones, obviously, if you have patients that have issues or have had issues with the IV fosaprepitant, you know, they don't have, obviously, because they're oral, the risk for the reaction or the injection site reaction. Right now, or up until now, your only other option has been to use the 3-day aprepitant, and then you run into adherence and they have to take it for 3 days. So, you know, it might offer an advantage in that setting, although I do know that some people just give all the aprepitant on day one or give it on day one. But, you know, so they're, at least right now, we don't have comparison data. So it's these sort of other things, other intangible things that might make you choose one over the other. You know, you don't have to, your pharmacy doesn't have to make, you know, rilopitant or NK1 antagonist or nitupatin. It could be in your Omnicell or whatever. So, you know, when you look at it, you know, obviously we all look at efficacy first, but if all that is equal, then you sort of start looking at some of these other things. And whether all those things are outweighed by the cost, that's up to, you know, that's up to each individual place or institution. Yes?
Yeah, hello. If a lot of my patients are going home with prochlorperazine, is there a buildup of side effect with olanzapine and prochlorperazine together?
So it's interesting that you said that. So when you talk to Rudy Navari and ask him what did he use for his breakthrough on his study, you know, he's like, I don't know. But when you talk to some of the other folks, so I have talked to folks and they have given prochlorperazine, compazine to their patients that are on olanzapine. I would say that even with all the excitement or the data with olanzapine, people are still very hesitant to switch to that. At least in my experience, I see people add it after the fact, which again sort of contradicts all that we're told about using everything you've got up front, but it still seems to be what people are doing. We have used the 4-drug regimen in patients that are getting cisplatin, that are young, that are female, that seem to have everything. We give them prochlorperazine as their breakthrough. So there's not really anything out there that says once, you know, if they're already on olanzapine, what's the best breakthrough? I think it's dealer's choice, really. And then you run into all the potential drug interactions and QTC prolongation, but so far that hasn't really borne out to be anything.
This concludes this podcast from the 2016 JADPRO Live at App Show Conference. To view the presentation material or see other topics of interest, please visit advancedpractitioner.com/sessions2016. To claim continuing educational credit for these activities, visit education.annenberg.net/JPL16-sessions.